The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. John Edgar Wideman's roots run deep in Philadelphia. He graduated from the University of Pennsylvania, and after becoming a Rhodes Scholar and studying at Oxford, he returned to his alma mater to teach and later coach basketball. He also became one of the few authors to be named a member of the Philadelphia Big Five Basketball Hall of Fame. Could be the only, I'm not sure. He won a Penn Faulkner Award and an American Book Award for Philadelphia Fire, and set his novels Cattle Killing and Two Cities here. We're pleased to have him back at the Free Library of Philadelphia this evening to discuss his latest work, Fanon. Please welcome John Edgar Wideman.
Good evening. It's always a pleasure to come back to Philadelphia. I mean, this is my evening. I can do whatever I want to. I can speak to the floor, to the ceiling. If you really want to hear what I say, I will speak in the mic. And thank you. But I'm not ready yet. I'm getting my stuff out and moving along, and I'll get to the mic. What was I saying? Oh, I was glad to be in Detroit. I really have deep roots. No. As some of you will know, these things become more and more important as the days go on, say nothing of the years. Not only that, but there are many different pairs, and then other problems begin to arise, like where is the right pair, and what's this I'm sitting on, and why does my backside feel... No, it's lovely. It's lovely to survive. It's lovely to have the opportunity to see the sunrise, to watch all these strange and wonderful things happening in our country. I guess what I've learned, both as writer and person, is that you don't know what's going to come next. You really don't know. And that's the worst thing about life, and it's also maybe the best thing. So here we are. And you don't know what I'm going to do, and I think I know what I'm going to do, but we'll see. Three things I want to do, and I'll do them in pretty rapid-fire order, I hope, efficiently. One is I want to urge you to buy this wonderful book called Fanon. It even looks good, good colors, good design, and Fanon is a very unusual person. Can everybody hear? Am I close enough to the mic? Okay. Fanon is a very exciting person, a person of great principles and powerful force. I'm not going to start talking about Fanon because that'll use up all my time. But Fanon is my subject for this book. I've been thinking about him maybe for 40 years in different ways, and this is one result, this book. The second thing I want to do, besides urge you to buy Fanon, is to talk about art. And that will be a very quick discourse. Art, I think, the art of writing, to be more specific, is a conscious attempt to use words to do more than lie or sell things. And that is the responsibility, and that is the duty of good writing, to do more than lie and to sell things. Language can accomplish other goals. And the writer's job is to keep reminding people of that, to keep reminding people that the language is alive as a personal instrument for sorting out things and naming things and experiencing reality. And the third thing I want to do is read to you a bit from this Fanon book and a bit from my project, which I hope, my new project, which is my attempt to keep the art of writing alive for me and for others. I'm launched on a group of very short fictions. I might call them quick fictions. I'm not sure of a title. If you have any ideas for what you might call a collection of pieces that are mainly about 1,000 words each, but have the ambition to be not prose poems or poems, but to be stories, to tell, to have a narrative line, to have characters, to have change, to have an arc of meaning, to connect in very specific ways to the world we live in. Maybe you'd say poetry tries to do all of that as well. But I think I think I understand, after working with fiction for all the years I have, that fiction is different and it does have distinct qualities. And I want to maintain those in these shorter pieces. And those will be sort of what I'll fill in with. We have about 30 minutes left, or 35. My attention span is probably no longer than yours. So we're safe. So those three things. And any questions you have about the stories or about Fanon or about why I happen to wind up here on this evening, we'll have time for that question and answer following the reading. So we're moving right along here. I'll read the epigraph. There, another pair of glasses. If you find a third pair, they're probably mine, too. I have them all over the house. I probably scattered some in the audience in case these break or I lose them. But this is an epigraph to the book Fanon, written by, these are Franz Fanon's words. And then I'll read something from the very end of the novel. The imaginary life cannot be isolated from real life. The concrete and the objective world constantly feed, permit, legitimate, and found the imaginary. The imaginary consciousness is obviously unreal, but it feeds on the concrete world. The imagination and the imaginary are possible only to the extent that the real world belongs to us. This is a scene that takes place in a conference of third world nations late in the 1950s, early in the 60s. Fanon attended many of these as a representative of the FLN, as a kind of a diplomat and organizer and goodwill ambassador from beleaguered Algeria, during the time that Algeria was fighting to free itself from France. Fanon became a freedom fighter and engaged himself in that Algerian War of Independence, which is interesting because not that many years before, he fought with the French army very valiantly and was wounded at least twice fighting the Nazis in Germany. So he was a man of principle, and where his principles took him, he risked his life. He took his life. He committed his life. But now he's the war's over, and these new, many of them new African nations who've just thrown off the yoke of colonialism are trying to get their act together, trying to make sense of this freedom and trying to use it as a tool to remove oppression from the citizens of these various nations. And that, of course, is not easy. And it was fraught with peril and it was fraught with corruption And it's a process that's still going on. And if you, I'm not asking you to be sympathetic or treat these African nations as anything special or different, because we gained our independence 400 years ago, and we're still trying to shake off some of the notions of aristocracy and the notions of inequality that we inherited from our former masters. So this is Fanon addressing these African delegates, mainly African delegates. Seated on the podium, Fanon despairs. How will anyone hear him? How will he hear himself above the buzz in the lobby? Limo doors slammed, helicopters taking off, planes landing, terrorist bombs exploding, the whisper of expensive trousers rubbing well-fed thighs. He watches a hand sliding down a row of plush seat backs as a delegate extricates himself from a front center seat. Excuse me, please, thank you, thank you. The delegate guiding himself by the feel of the seats, politely trampling others' feet, battering their knees, then hurrying, almost a sprint on tiptoe, up the aisle to the door where his picture is snapped, and he blinks and bumps slightly a delegate entering as he leaves, the newcomer's eyes accustoming themselves to darkness, searching out an empty space to occupy until pressing affairs summon him away. Who passes out masks and forces the delegates to wear them? Who decides the masks must be black or white? What colors lie beneath the masks? Will I live to see their faces unveiled? Fanon wonders. When delegates return home, would they be visible without black masks or white masks? Will they ever be free to remove their masks or only exchange white for black, black for white? It's too late. Masks do not disguise truth. Masks are true, the pure, absolute, reassuring truth of black or white. Pure illusion, pure white or pure black. Masks truer than the gray shadow staring back from a mirror, your unconvincing reflection that does not disguise the blazing emptiness behind it. You pretend not to see. Stop, Fanon tells himself. Delegates are not wearing masks. They are blind. The conference, a school for the blind, teaching delegates to manage a world they cannot see, a world where sightlessness is an asset, not a handicap, if you learn the rules. Follow instructions. Everybody's blind, equally secure, and terrorized by blindness. And who am I if I am not a delegate? Fanon asks. A delegate representing myself first and then others, perhaps. Yes and no, because who am I without those others? But I am not those others. Who pays my way? Whom do I owe? What am I demanding from other delegates attending the conference? Why should they risk anything on behalf of Algerians fighting for independence from France? Algerians I claim to represent. Do delegates gathered here represent anyone besides themselves? Do they love anyone? My brother, my likeness. He often recites those words of Baudelaire to remind himself that what he despises most in another is also always his own face mirrored in their features, his actions doubled by theirs. No matter how clinically accurate and irrefutable his observations of others, in the end, he is the bulky mule he lashes, the impatient rider straddling his own sweaty back. Who am I? Why am I here, pretending to be someone solid, substantial, I cannot be? Someone pure and true, I think I might wish to be. The circle unbroken. Delegates are hostages, hoods over our heads, an act of mercy, blinding us to the truth of our blindness. Speak. Rise to the podium and speak. It's your turn now, Fanon. A sea of faces waiting for him to strip off his clothes, dash into the water, and drown. His brothers armed with volleys of applause to fire at speakers who parade to the lectern, rooting them on, shooting them down one by one to cleanse the stage for the next pretender to the throne. None of the little monarchs at home or sitting out there on their regal butts is prepared to relinquish until brute force deposes him. Vive le roi, vive le roi est mort. Why such dire estimates of your brothers, Fanon? Why the small suppressed tingle of excitement, of complicity, upon sighting white faces scattered here and there in the front rows? In the hall, colored faces could swallow uncolored faces as easily as tall waves gulp down churning limbs. Only a spattering of white faces, some of those colored, no doubt. No doubt some of the uncolored, more friendly, more simpatico, as is often the case, than many of the colored. Why is he quibbling over the meaning of these different shades of color or no color his gaze supplies, as if color makes a difference? Why ponder this incompleteness, these uncolored spaces that with a little effort could or should be painted differently? Would the absence of uncolored faces render a unanimous verdict on who belongs here, who owns the conference, who it serves? Why? Is he secretly pleased by a sprinkling of so-called whites, by the irony that the issue of their removal is on the conference agenda? Will they have a vote, yes or no, to tease themselves? Which is it, the presence or absence of their faces, that signifies the conference's success? Though few, are the few precious, because without them, the sea he's facing from the podium doesn't exist on the map of the larger world, the map that ancestors of these precious few drew centuries ago, the ancient map of wishful thinking, a cartoon map, really, outmoded then and now. Beware, dragons be here. A map with distortions of scale, flat-out lies and conscious misrepresentations, embedded superstitions and ignorance. A map of dreams, a pretty-up picture of Europe's unspeakable nightmares and aspirations. A map adorned on its margins with occult symbols, coats of arms, saints, imps, mermaids, monsters, portraits of pale faces and pale bodies, beautiful as angels. A fairy tale map abiding till today, this very instant, Fanon unseats himself and slowly walks toward the lantern, lectern, for his turn to speak. Won't these very steps take their measure from the old map? His six or seven strides, meaningless, not counting as steps, unless they are plotted on that old map of continents, countries, islands, and seas, the map drawn by a few dreaming hands, by the same ones, their numbers still small, who retain the power in their hands, their heads, to draw the old map again and again and squeeze a whole world onto a parchment grid, making it, then and now, everybody's map. White, brown, black, red, yellow, green, establishing scale and relationship among peoples, among things, determining the place of things, their absolute largeness, smallness, significance. Near East, Far East, West, First World, Third World, on top or down under. the map missing the sea of brown faces Fanon looks out upon. And no matter how deep and dense this sea appears to him, that immensity does not exist, cannot be located, a blank site, a terre inconnue, emptied of meaning once and forever by the map makers because they chose to render no shape for it, appended no names but theirs, left it as an invisible island, floating, drowning, a hole, a fearful void in a greater sea that surrounds it, washes over it, conceals it from sight and time. Unless the map, as Fanon understands it, the map that erases him by erasing itself, by erasing him, unless the map can be flipped over to its unwritten side, and then, perhaps, you could begin a fresh drawing of the world. Speak. And so, with the magic carpet of fiction and language, we leave that conference room somewhere, probably in Africa or Asia, and we come, of all places, to where?
Philadelphia.
Cujo, after the bombing and fire in Philadelphia. On his first morning back, after 10 years on a Greek island, running, hiding 10 years, he could confess and smile now. Scruffy turf of Clark Park bristling through his sandals' thin soles. Empty hoop court, a lover nodding, as if she had known all along he couldn't stay away. Moldy old brass Dickens, still asleep on his stone throne, and little Nell below, still green and imploring. The flesh and blood of innocence, born here 8 months ago by the fire's black smoke and ash, must have soaked into the soil by now, risen in dew and vapor, falling again in rain to feed grassy patches surviving here and there. Rain spiking the perfume of clusters of tiny white flowers, spattering some of those short trees or tall bushes along the path above the hollow, glistening, he thinks. Spring, he thinks. Running steps, almost silent behind him now, cool and quiet as dark heaps of garments cast off, abandoned here, beneath anything taller than a few inches. And across the state to Pittsburgh. And my mom presiding on the 6th floor of the Leroy Orvis homes, where she looked down on the street and made sure every day that everything was okay, including that the sun had risen and etc., other smaller things. Witness. Sitting here one night, 6 floors up on my little balcony, when I heard shots and saw them boys running. My eyes went straight to the lot beside Mason's bar, and I saw something black, not moving in the weeds, and knew a body lying there, and knew it was dead. A 15-year-old boy, the paper said. Whole bunch of sirens and cops and spinning lights the night I'm talking about. I watched till after they rolled him away, and then everything got quiet again, as it ever gets round here. So I'm sure the boys' people not out there that night. Didn't see them till next morning, when I'm looking down at those weeds, and a couple's coming slow on Frankstown Avenue with a girl by the hand, had to be the boys' baby sister. They pass terrible Masons and stop right at the spot the boy died. Then they commence to swaying, bowing, hugging, waving their arms about. Forgive me, Jesus, but look like they grief dancing, like the sidewalk too cold or too hot. They had to jump around not to burn up. How'd his people find the exact spot? Maybe they heard my old mind working to guide them, lead them, like I would if I could get up out this goddamn wheelchair and take them by the hand. We'll stay there a while. Ghetto. The king is dead. He lifts his wet son from the crib. A quiet, quiet baby, soaked, and he protests not. No outcry yesterday when a water bug prowled the crib, settled on his fat beige cheek. His son's mother, the one who hollers when she discovers the huge black insect, flicks it off, snatches up her baby, and screams in fear for help for the father to kill or shoo or rescue, a blood-curdling cry if he'd ever heard one, him racing naked from bed to the alcove they called the baby's room to find her pushed against the wall furthest from the crib, clutching their son to her breast, her face 100 years older than when he'd switched off the bed lamp that night. How could the baby still be so young, so quiet in the arms of an ancient mother who weeps, "We've got to get out of here. We've got to get out of here." Yesterday, scared woman with baby clamped to her bosom, bare-ass man gawking at the monster in the crib, a picture in a magazine or seen in a movie, he couldn't say where, though without a doubt familiar with a kind of deja vu authority, a frozen moment that waits for him to renew their acquaintance. Yesterday, the day they shot King in Memphis, just yesterday at this same early morning hour, streets still dark outside, he'd run here naked, summoned by a scream, yanking him from the muddle through which he floats every morning before he opens his eyes, before his conscious mind sneaks or bullies its way into wakefulness, that tired conversation with himself. "Come on, boy, move your sorry black ass, boy." Tired before he rolls out of bed, tired of finding himself in the same dead-end place where he dropped off to sleep. Wide awake yesterday, he'd run here and scooped the beetle from the crib in a mitt of pamper, lucky to grab a wet, not a shitty one, from the wastebasket on the changing table. With all his might, he'd squeezed the thick wad, hoping to hear a nasty pop. Twice he slammed it down on the dresser top, under the hard meat of his hand, then hurled it to the floor, stomping, grinding, white plastic and paper flat under his bare heel. Just yesterday, the baby quiet through the whole silly business. Quiet this morning, 24 hours later, lifted wet from his crib. What does his son remember about yesterday? What will he tell him? The king's dead. And we'll stay in Pittsburgh for just another minute. I like Pittsburgh too. Now it could be Philadelphia. For the boy, the new car and the big man who owned it were for a couple months the best things on the lower end of the block, down from Walnut, holding the few raggedy houses on Copeland, where the few colored in Shadyside, Pittsburgh, PA, lived. Mercury sedan, three bright shades of green, four doors, yards of chrome, windows so the thin, low-slung roof floated on a sea of spotless glass or light, and Big Jim, who people said went downtown each morning for a week and sat his close to 400 pounds with a baseball bat across his lap in the Duquesne Light office until they came and turned his electricity back on. In a summer, Jet magazine printed a photo of Emmett Till's face, looked like a black bug somebody squashed under their thumb. The boy, almost exactly Emmett Till's age, couldn't get enough of the spit-shined F-86 Sabre jet streamline Merc, or its double man-sized owner. "Get your tail in here, boy," his father's iceberg voice from the kitchen. "Why didn't you come in the house when your mother called you last night?" "Wasn't late, Daddy. Not hardly past 8 o'clock. Didn't ask you what the time was." "Don't care what time of day or night, boy. When your mother tells you do something, you know you better do it, and quick." "She called me out the window. I wasn't nowhere, Daddy, just sitting downstairs right across the street in Big Jim's car where Mom could see me." "Since when you grown enough to be sitting around at night in somebody's car?" "Wasn't going nowhere, Daddy." "Then what you two doing in that damn car?" "Nothing." "What'd he say to you?" "Nothing, Daddy." "Well, I'll be talking to Mr. Big Jim soon as I get home from work tomorrow. Meanwhile, you're grounded, boy. Don't set foot out the door without you ask your mother. And if she say yes, don't you even think about going nowhere near that lard-ass yellow man or his shit-green car." Three-toned green. Three colors of fad that summer. All kinds of brand new shiny rides and crazy color combinations dazzle the streets. The Emmett Till story, two-toned, black on white, old-timey terrible shit white men do to black boys down south. Not until a long time afterward would the boy begin to make any kind of precise sense of his deep fear, his father's deep anger, his own deep anger, his father's deep fear. The peacock cars, hate and terror and love. How in certain ways during that summer of 1955, all of it connects, including splashy, wobbly colors of a World Series in a store window on Walnut Street on those new RCA color TVs and the snowy, flip-flopping black and whites they'd keep watching for years down on his end of the block. Father makes me think of more, Father. "They stole my money," my father says. "I know exactly what you mean, man," I could have responded, but I don't want to get him started on that frozen poem of frustration and rage he can't help reciting, stanza by stanza, because the thieves won't send him the prizes their letters declare he's won. "I've come to take away his car keys, or rather do what our worried family has decided, ask for his car keys. We've tried before." "No way, Jose," he let us know. "Me and that old girl, automatic. Drive this whole city blindfolded." Today it's as if he knew before I knocked someone would be coming by, and there would be less of him left as soon as he opened his door. So he reminded me, whatever my good intentions, that I'm just like all those others who'd lied, stripped, and stolen from him his entire life and aren't finished yet, vultures circling closer and closer, withholding his prizes, picking his bones because an old black man too tired to shoo them off anymore. His quick mind leaving him fast, but thank goodness my father no pack rat. Until the end, his apartment fairly neat. He keeps only the final letters in their boldly colored big print envelopes, guaranteeing a Corvette or condo in Acapulco or million in cash mega prize. Beside his bed and on the table, large stacks of these lying motherfuckers that taunt and obsess him. His last chance, a glorious grand finale promise, though how and when not precisely spelled out in the fine print. He never figures out the voices on the other end of his daily 800 calls are robots. Curses the menus, the women's voices chirp. His response to my request, he surrender his keys gentler. A slightly puzzled glance a smile, breaking my heart. No, Daddy, no, don't do it. I'm crying out helplessly, silently, as he passes me the keys. Just a couple more. Give you an idea what I'm trying to do. Dear Madonna. Dear Madonna, this is my first letter to a famous person, and I'm not sure about protocol. Am I presuming too much familiarity by addressing my letter to your first name, Madonna? If so, please forgive me, because I know only one name for you. Do you have a last name? Or maybe Madonna is your family name. I've read that truly famous require only one name, like Jesus. So maybe addressing you as Madonna is a compliment, a tribute to your celebrity. I can't think of many women in history who have single name recognition. Joan needs of Arc. Catherine needs the Great. Anyway, since Madonna is the only name of yours I know, I'm wasting your time and mine with this protocol business. I've also read one doesn't need to put an address on a letter to a famous person. The post office understands where hers rarely, if ever, mail should be delivered, like Santa and the president. But the president doesn't count exactly, does he? No, she yet. Maybe you should run, Madonna. Because, for instance, the post office would be puzzled by an envelope with only George written on it. Unless it also said President of the United States, and, well, that's clearly more than a single name. In a way, Madonna, I feel much more at ease already calling you Madonna after writing so much to you, if you've read this far, Madonna. But that's not what I started out to say in this sentence. The point I wanted to make is that maybe you're more famous, Madonna, than the president. Although a letter addressed to President with a capital P might reach the present president, this George, who I doubt very much, would read a letter from me. Besides, I would never feel comfortable being on a first-name basis with such a dangerous person. What would I write to him anyway, especially since he probably wouldn't open my letter? Maybe I'd write, "Make love, not war," a famous slogan from a bygone era when I was lots younger. Yes, Madonna, I must admit I'm quite a bit older than you. And now that that cat's out the bag, as well as the cat of my dead giveaway reference to love with a capital L, I might as well confess, if you've read this far and haven't guessed, this is a love letter, pure and simple, Madonna. When I read of your intention to adopt another child, I realized you, too, must be suffering a void in your emotional life. Given your fabled unconventionality and courageous trailblazing, why attempt to fill your void in such an unoriginal fashion? Adopt an old man instead. What could a smelly, squalling baby do for you, Madonna, that an old man couldn't do better? Adopt me, Madonna. I could furnish you 1,000 convincing reasons, make 1,000 promises, but I'm afraid you won't read them. But just think, Madonna, if you adopted me, you could take my name, and nobody, including lovesick letters like this one, would know how to find you. Two more. And then I think I've fulfilled my contract. I get my $10,000 and go back to. Cuckoo. I'm learning their lingo. The birds I hear first thing mornings, last thing at night. 10:30, 11. My dinner about over. Light dying late, dinner late, as is the custom this far west and north in Brittany. Birds whose distinctive pigeony cuckooing frames my days, you could say. A presence I can count on afternoons as well, when I sit and read in my garden. They coo loud and often, especially in these mid July days, which I guess might be their mating season because of fierce, invisible rackets exploding deep in thick foliage, and the birds' goofy arrogance on the roads, strutting or puttering along, tiny heads bobbing with ghetto, bebop nonchalance till the very last instant before they dodge a car's tires, pale breasts teasing inches above an onrushing windshield, then lifting fast and furiously miles overhead, their faraway cries shattering rural calm. Mourning doves, or turtle doves, might be their name in English. And what French calls the birds, I have no clue, and really don't care, because I'm too busy teaching myself the birds' language. Not phrases or sentences yet, a single word at a time. I hear loneliness at dawn, and loneliness again at dusk, and in between, only the frantic beating of wings, endless chasing, one coo-cooing at another, whether another listens or not, each solitary cry a sounding of this world's silence that vanishes in another world's silence, every cry the same and different, an eloquent, careful repetition and mocking echo of itself, a language of mirrors, I'm learning cuckoo, cuckoo, cuckoo. Now, I guess this is an appropriate one to end with. Now you see it. This might be the title for the book of these, you know, the quick now you see it, now that's the, so now you see it. You come to a space on the page and can't read further, because in this space resides everything the writer does not know, cannot know, but pretends to know. The face of a god, for instance, the emptiness and fullness of time, perfect silence, voices of the dead returning, all crammed clamoring into this white space between two words, or space dividing blocks of print, as if the unnameable, unimaginable, can be put on hold in a space the writer may have chosen to leave blank in order to suggest a plan or design or transition, or simply provide a rest stop for pilgrims in the story before they pick up their burdens and continue their journey. But whatever the writer's intent, the space suddenly uncrossable, too much missing, too much erased. You falter, unclear why you've read this far. No choice now, because the space yawns wider and wider, sucking down the whole world, including the writer's dream of it, dreamed up to fashion a story. Fashion a space within the story for yours, you. And there is no going forward, no going back. Nothing survives the space. No page, no words, no safe passage the writer promised through roaring silence that closes like the sea closes over heads of creatures who can't swim. The story gone before the writer's next word reaches you. So we are now to part 7, or whatever, wherever we are. And so questions, answers, statements, whatever. Well, that was easy. Yes. Yes.
I wonder if you ever considered writing poetry since you have such a poetic prose style.
I resent that question. I think prose writers have just as much a right to use the language in expressive and imaginative and metaphorical ways as poets. It's different, But sometimes when people say my writing sounds poetic, I get worried because I think maybe they were sort of sleeping and just, you know, let the words wash over them the way I listen to poems often. But it can also be a very high compliment indeed, and I tend to take it that way because it means that the language is, it's not the language of a newspaper article or a recipe or directions on how to get across the Walt Whitman Bridge from Tokyo. You know, it means that you're pushing the language. It means that the language is being used in a creative and original way. And that's what I mean when I say, when I'm kidding and say I kind of resent it, because I think good writing is good writing, and poets and fiction writers inhabit that same territory. And when we're at our best, we have equal rights to those aspects of language. Or at least we try. Yes?
Your university in Pennsylvania connection, could you tell us?
Hurrah for the red and the blue. I haven't gotten a check recently from Penn, so that's one connection I don't have any longer. But I was an undergrad there. Spent 4 years and then went away and studied abroad and came back and taught there for something like 10 years, 11 years. And it was a very exciting time at Penn. Penn was a pretty hidebound conservative institution. It did certain jobs very, very well, and like most good schools in America, didn't think it needed to do much more than that, even though it sat right plumb in the middle of a huge African-American urban community. And had never had kids from that community, in fact, attend Penn. So there were not iron walls or stone walls and guard towers and machine guns, but there was an effective isolation and separation, not only from the black community, but probably from Philadelphia in general. And it was the 60s, and some of us, many people much more so than myself, didn't want that, didn't like that. We thought there was something wrong with that. And so we were anxiously trying to recruit students to Penn who looked a little different than the traditional student, not because we thought that they were poor little kids and we needed to give them a break, but because they had something to offer the university which was missing. And they had those talents in abundance, and we knew that if it worked, the university would be a better place, as well as the kids having an opportunity to do something that they wouldn't get in the normal run of things. So ideas like that were in the air, and it was very exciting for me to start on the academic side an African-American program, and I learned a lot about admissions. There were some very good admissions officers, one who passed recently, Bill Adams, and his wife, survived now by his wife, Carol, and they did an awful good job of fighting the good fight, and administrators at Penn, and I was proud of my institution, and for all the falling on our face that we did regularly and still do. But that's my relationship, and since then I've gone back and been part of the Kelly's Writers Series, and I think I got a degree along with some other very famous people. They all came in stretch limos. And I had a mini limo, but you know, I was feeling good that day. Yes.
I've read some of your work, but I didn't know you had taken a degree in philosophy.
That's a generic word in the English university. It's just a Bachelor of Philosophy. It means it's not an undergrad. Well, I've read a lot of philosophy, and I think a lot about it, and Fanon, of course, is a philosopher among other things. But no, I have no formal training. I took classes at Penn. Speaking of Penn, William Fontaine was one of the few African American faculty members in the School of Arts and Sciences when I was there, and my poor little dark head was so turned around that I kind of avoided him. He scared me. I didn't know what to make of him. And I must admit, somewhere, even in my little oppressed brain, I thought, well, he's probably not as good as the other guys. That's what oppression can do to one. And I will regret that till my dying day. I later saw a picture of the same Bill Fontaine in Paris at the first international gathering of writers and artists, along with Du Bois and along with Cesar. And I said, geez, I had a chance to touch that man, to learn so much. And I just was brainwashed so that I was not capable of taking advantage. Yes, sir.
Is Professor C.D. Wright on your staff, isn't she?
At Brown?
Yeah.
Oh, she's an ornament of the staff. She is the staff, yes.
Yeah. Say hello to her for Richard Moyer. I was in her group out in the writing conference in California a few years ago.
She spent some time in a big federal prison, not as an inmate, but as a but as an artist in residence, and she worked along with a photographer. This is C.D. Wright, poet, and she wrote poems about the people in prison there, men and women, and the photographer took their pictures. And it's quite a book if you can find it anywhere. It's a rare book. It's quite an unusual book. And since then, she's also because the book was so expensive and only a few copies were printed, she's done taking the poems out and made them into a book. And it's a very sensitive look at a population most of us would have nothing to do with. But she does good work. She recently won a MacArthur to recognize that good work.
What's the book called?
That I can't say. I can't say. It has something like Life or Lifers or in the title, but C.D. Wright, and the title will identify itself if you Google her name or go to a bookstore. Yes?
So I believe you were at Amherst for a number of years?
Yes.
How would you compare and contrast your experience on the faculty at Amherst with your Penn experience?
There are good writers everywhere. Doesn't matter how much tuition the kids pay, and I had or are able to pay. I had a number of people publish books in both since then, in both places. In a funny way, the kids at UMass. Well, I taught mostly graduate students, so it's not exactly fair. But I did teach enough undergraduates, so I got a sense of undergraduates both places. And at an institution like UMass, it's a state school. So just about anybody who can get the money together or get scholarship together is able to go. But they had the ambition to compete with the very good private schools, including Harvard, it's one of them, in Massachusetts. And that was sort of the mandate of UMass, at least some of the campuses. But the students were not, in one sense, as well prepared. By the time kids got to Penn, they were pretty well read and pretty sophisticated in good and bad ways. So at a place like UMass, you do a lot more hardcore teaching. You have to get the basics. You have to acquaint people with the basics of what you're doing, what they're interested in. But that's fun. I enjoy that because it keeps me going back to the basics and remembering where it all begins, the kind of P's and Q's and all that. So it's just different. But the young people are young people. Yes?
I'm really interested that you wrote about Fanon. I mean, The Wretched of the Earth was like you had to read that in the 60s and 70s, and he was, very, very important. Why Fanon now? You began to say a little bit at the beginning about colonialist mind, and I just wanted to know, why did Fanon speak to you now in 2008?
Well, that's why you have to buy the book. That secret. And as a matter of fact, there is a kind of explicit answer to that question in the very first section of the book. It's a letter to Fanon, and it's pretty much of a confession of an obsession that I've had with him for a long time. But you can read that on your own. And I mean, it was actually published in Harper's Magazine. If you don't want to buy the book, I'll give a trade secret away, that introductory section. But for those of you who will never buy the book or look up Harper's Magazine or couldn't care less, you get to hear a slightly different version, 24 words or less. Fanon was an extremely honest man, an extremely principled man. He took on a very complex and difficult and emotional subject. And he was thorough and dogged in his determination to figure out why and how his sense of being a human being had been crippled by growing up in a colonial society. A society divided into two different classes, at least, the colonized and the colonizers, mostly the natives who were dark people and the French who were European people. He knew that that experience had hurt him, hurt his country, hurt his family, and he was determined to figure it out. Why? How? Not just out of curiosity, because he wanted to change it. And many people have embarked on that. The way he did it, the way he conducted his attempt to understand is special. I won't go there for the moment. I'll just say the other thing he was determined about is that the reason or the purpose of that inquiry was not to put himself in a position of replicating the inequality and the imbalance that is represented by that Manichaean world of black and white. In other words, it was not about making black over white just because he had suffered as black under white. It was about making everybody more human and destroying the categories of race, which he determined were the real problem. And I respect that quite a bit. Now, I think there's a lesson in there that we have not absorbed as a culture, as a society, as a world, for all that matters. And so it's been fascinating for me to see him walk that line. He was not like Dr. King exactly, because Fanon felt that this experience of colonialism had such force and such power that it had to be removed. The foot had to be taken off your neck before you could become human. And the person whose foot was on your neck had to come to terms with what he or she was doing before they could become more human. And so if you talked and talked and talked and the foot still didn't come up, then you might have to reach around and snatch it off or get strong enough that you can shrug it off. So he believed not simply in turning the other cheek, but he believed that the objective of any freedom struggle is freedom, not the repression of another group, not the putting down of other people, that human beings are essentially in this all together, benighted as some of us are at certain times. So that's the nutshell version. And I think we hear someone else trying to say some of these same things to us right now. Maybe more than one person. But that message is being heard, I think, and being attended to in a way I wouldn't have dreamed even 5 years ago. Tell the truth even 5 months ago. 5 minutes ago. Yes. Well, if I really knew, I would set up shop in Las Vegas. I wouldn't tell you. It's fun to talk about literature, and literature is about ideas, and literature is about politics, and literature is about power and all that. But you didn't come here for me to suggest for whom you should vote. But I'll say this. I won't mention any candidate's name. I don't know which candidate would make a better president. I don't think anybody knows that. The world's too volatile, too strange. So we don't really know which candidate would make a better president. But I think I know which candidate would make a better America.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.